I think we have a quorum. We can go ahead and the first order of business is reports from standing committees.
February the 2nd, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 110, State Education Accountability and Assessment 2. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, and Wasserberger. No, Senator Ross. Senator Ross, Chairman. Scott.
No more reports. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, with that order of business, general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself back into general... Committee to hold, discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion's been passed. It's been granted. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman.
The committee of the whole will come back to order. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
You certainly may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, you should have on your desk an outline of the schedule. We put that together. It ties into what we were talking about the other day. It's pretty self-explanatory. I don't really need to go through it. It's just for your information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Kinski's granted.
Professional Learning Community. Please welcome Nick Weiss.
There, there.
All right. The first file for our consideration is Senate File 132. The reading clerk will please read the file.
Senate File 132, Wyoming Fair Housing Act, sponsored by Senator Scott. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinsey, Von Flader, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
For the reading of the file, what is your pleasure, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 132. Here to explain that bill is Senator Scott.
Senator Scott, and there is a standing committee amendment.
Mr. Chairman, can we read the standing committee amendment at this
time? We certainly can.
Senate File 132, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Page 3, lines 21 and 22.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, unless the committee chairman wants to do it.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Senate File 132.
Do you have any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman, this is one of those things where we have to stay substantially equivalent to a federal act, and the Standing Committee Amendment does that. It does specify the enforcing authority here. This is something unique. The feds will allow not only state agencies but nonprofits to be the enforcing authority. This leaves it open. It may be the governor will designate a state agency like the attorney general. It may be they'll feel he will probably negotiate with the realtors and they'll come up with someone. The feds will provide the funding through grants is the testimony that we heard. The other things the standing committee amendment does, the realtors have trademarked their name and they get all uptight about it being used in laws. And I suppose there's a risk of trademark protection litigation. So we changed realtors to real estate licensees, deleted brokers in the process. And then page 31, first is replacing a must with a shall. That's conforming to our drafting standards. And then the bill, as it came to us, was copied off North Dakota, and they put their money in the general fund that comes from fines and penalties. By constitution, we put ours in the common school fund in the county in which the offense occurred. So that's what the amendment does. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions and urge the adoption of the amendment.
Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment?
Questions.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 132, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment is carried. Back to you, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, to explain the bill, as I said, this is one of those, and we have a number of them in our statutes, where if we pass something that is substantially similar to a federal law, then we can take over the enforcement and the administration of that law. We've done it quite successfully in a number of the environmental areas, a number of the other areas. We're trying to do it here with relating to fair housing. The first question we've got to ask with one of these, Mr. Chairman, is do we agree with what the feds are fundamentally trying to do here? And I would submit to the Senate that we do and we should. The key provision is found on page 5, starting at the top of page 5. And this is what this law is prohibiting. And it's just 4 or 5 lines, so I'll read it. A person may not refuse to sell or rent after making a bona fide offer, refuse to negotiate for the sale or rental of, or in any other manner, make unavailable or deny a dwelling to an individual because of race, color, religion, sex, disability, family status, or national origin. The principle is that you don't discriminate in selling and renting housing. There is an exception in here relating to the sale of a single-family residence by an individual that owns it. It's a little more extensive than that. It's really aimed at the people who are renting or selling as a business. And, Mr. Chairman, I would submit to the Senate that that's the basic principle, is something we all ought to support and adhere to. And frankly, I will say to you that in my experience in the past 40 years since I first ran, and I ran once unsuccessfully for the legislature and have continued to run, as I go door to door, I have seen a tremendous change in our community. When I started out in my community, there was kind of a ghetto. If you're a minority, that's where you went. And that is no longer true. People are scattered all over town. And it's my impression, Mr. Chairman, that our citizenry has said that this business of discriminating on the basis of race or something like that is just wrong. And we don't do it anymore. And it's been a real positive to witness, Mr. Chairman, that change in a very fundamental way. And I think it's a compliment to the citizenry of our state and to our society that change has taken place. But there are still a few individuals who haven't got the word. And this bill is dealing with those, and I think it's appropriate. Now, why do we want to assume control over this function, Mr. Chairman? Well, right now, if you have a complaint that you're denied housing on a discriminatory basis, you have to make the complaint at the Denver office of the U.S. Department known as HUD, Housing and Urban Development. And they're overwhelmed with complaints from some of our larger neighboring states that don't behave as well as we do. And your complaint gets short shrift, and it's expensive to go down to Denver either to pursue it or to defend against one that's unjustified. and the testimony that there's 20 to 25 of these complaints a year. Most of them prove unfounded and aren't pursued, but it would be a service to our citizens on both sides of the issue to be able to get it resolved locally with local people and a lot cheaper. So that's what this bill does. It is a priority of the realtors who are seeing the problem firsthand, and I think we will do a service to our citizens by making the resolution of these complaints available locally. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions. We could go through the bill in great detail, but I don't think it's necessary. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions on this bill? Senator Anderson.
Curious on page 15, line 7 through 10, about the membership in the religions and restricted things. I'm just curious about that, what that all means. It's something about the same religion, and then it goes on for more religious restrictions. Just curious what that means. Page 15, lines 7 through 10.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we're talking here about a religious organization, society, nonprofit, are operating in conjunction from limiting sale owns of an occupancy of dwellings that owns operates for other than a commercial purpose to individuals of the same religion. Unless membership in the religion is restricted because of race, color, or national origin. I don't think we have that anymore on line 10. But as I read it, that if a religious society is providing housing to some of its members, say as would be done perhaps in my district out at the Martin's Cove area out beyond Independence Rock. I think you have a church-operated thing out there. I think they provide housing there. They can restrict that to their own members. The number of the churches will provide residences for some of their clergy, actually, and things like that. That, as I read it, that's what this is all about. Now, if they're just doing it as a commercial business, they'll be treated like everybody else. But if they're doing it specifically for the members of their religion, that would be permissible. And I think nobody, Mr. Chairman, should object to that.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Further questions on this bill? Further questions on this bill? The question is on Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 132. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 132 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 62.
Senate File 62, Oral Chemotherapy Parity, sponsored by Senator Anderson. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so the recommendation that Senate File 62 do pass. There was no standing committee amendment, and I yield to Senator Anderson, 02, for an explanation of the Senate file.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, I come to you today with Senate File 62 having to do with oral chemotherapy parity. The way we treat cancer is changing with new types of oral chemotherapy medications, and I'm talking about pills as such, playing an increasingly important role. Studies that show oral chemotherapies, when compared with the administration intravenously, not only decrease the number of doctor's visits and help decrease overall health costs, but they also improve quality of life and reduce the patient's work costs. So to help frame the discussion today, we're talking about two methods of cancer treatment, that being oral treatment by means of a pill, the other being chemotherapy as a result of intravenous injections. The problem patients face quite often is how treatments are classified by insurance companies. IV therapy is part of your medical benefits. In that, you pay copay to receive those treatments by intravenous injections. Oral therapy is typically classified under the pharmaceutical benefit. See the two different types of treatment, two different types of insurance, which means patients then pay coinsurance or a portion of the drug costs, and most usually at a higher cost to them, which comes then out of pocket. Senate File 62 seeks to address the problem of inequitable costs to the cancer patient by requiring health plans to equalize patients' out-of-pocket costs between oral and IV therapies. The bill is simple. It equalizes the cost to the patient. I've provided with you a handout that looks somewhat like this, stapled to some other things. It is, I hope, a more visual representation explanation of the concepts that I'm presenting to you today. I encourage you to read that information as well. Draw your attention to the bill, which impacts and who it does not impact. Now, we as a state legislature impact, we can't impact everyone as a state legislature, but we cannot impact all insurance plans or coverage. So this is actually a pretty relative small group of people that we're talking about. There are some questions and concerns that have been raised about the bill that I think are important to discuss, and I'll try to answer some of those questions in anticipation thereof. Is Senate File 62 a mandate? Under the ACA, it's not really considered a mandate. Testimony in committee from proponents and opponents as well alike confirmed that Senate File 62 is not a mandate that will increase any costs back to the state. No costs are incurred here that the state would have liability in. In regard to mandates for cancer coverage, this is a key point. Senate File 62 does not mandate that policies have to cover cancer. It simply requires that if the patient has cancer coverage, their cost would be the same regardless of treatment, that the two treatment plans, if it were to be intravenous or if it were to be oral, then there would be parity between the two. For a minute, just think about a person who has purchased insurance their entire life. They're prepared for the worst comes and they're told the best course of treatment is a pill or oral treatment, but that pill or that method of oral treatment comes with a 50% co-insurance. Now, if you're that person, wouldn't you question why you ever purchased the insurance? Cancer is cancer, chemotherapy is chemotherapy. The issue isn't the fault, it's not the fault of the insurance companies. High drug costs are driving the problem, and we all know drug costs are on the rise. And yes, they're expensive. Technology is advancing the medical field, and getting a drug to market is admittedly incredibly expensive. I personally view this somewhat differently. It's not the patient's fault either. They bought insurance. They were responsible, but because of a plan benefit design, they pay out-of-pocket costs. I don't believe that's fair. I don't believe that it's right. Cost controls need to be on the pharmaceutical side. Interesting argument, and it sounds compelling. The question I pose is, what happens when drugs go generic? Do premiums decrease? Costs are another issue we might address. We have, and I would ask, I think, to pass out the graph in regard to costs, and while we're talking about costs, that'll be coming out. Review of 31 drugs approved by the FDA since 2000. And you'll see on the charts that are coming forward, and I should have probably had these come, but these oral agents appear to be 30 to 55% less expensive than the IV agents when comparing wholesale acquisition costs, referred to as a WAC. Drug costs only, the comparison does not include physical administration or comparing costs, only to add the cost of IV chemotherapy. So the two remaining points, and you see it on the original handout, 34 states have already enacted a similar under similar legislation. You'll see that on the maps that were provided to the attachment. No state has reported a significant increase in premium. Costs have been minimal. Costs may raise, and this was given in testimony in committee, Wyoming has a rather small population. Wyoming has rather small insurance pools. One of our major insurance company indicated that it might possibly raise insurance premiums about to the effect of about $1.30 to $1.50 per month. Don't know yet. Some states have indicated that it's a percent of a percent that it would raise medical premiums. You can't receive IV therapy everywhere in Wyoming. The rural nature of our communities means patients are driving, sometimes long distance, to receive intravenous care. This adds an additional burden to the patient, family, employer. That concept has particular resonance to me because I live in a community that does not have the ability to provide intravenous care, and so patients have to drive a considerable distance to either Casper, Cheyenne, Cody, Jackson, Gillette, Laramie, Riverton, Rock Springs, or Sheridan in order to receive intravenous treatment, whereas if they could simply get a pill at a reasonable cost in their rural or home community, that would also be a considerable saving of driving. So in closing, or in summary, this bill prohibits coverage being higher between IV and oral therapies, period. In other words, you could not charge more for oral medication than you could for IV treatment. For those patients who bought insurance, planned for the worst, this bill is about patients paying the same amount, having affordable access to care, I think you should support the bill because I think it's the right thing to do. Today's cancer patients have two concerns, their health and their ability to pay for treatment. And in the event they're not able to afford the treatment, they tend to avoid it, and that drives in a higher cost, giving a more extreme or the worsening of a condition. In that instance, it could very well then fall back to the state to help through other types of more extreme treatment. Many of us in here in this bill is not about the emotional aspects. I don't mean to say that it is, but many of us in here have had cancer. We've had experience with cancer with not only ourselves, but with our families. It's probably one of the most memorable phrases of my life when my doctor told me that I had cancer. Fortunately, I'm a 10-year survivor. I had no requirement for chemo or oral therapy, you know, any kind of chemotherapy. But for those who do and have this battle to fight, advances in cancer screenings and treatment mean that those who are diagnosed today have a better chance of beating cancer than survivors and be survivors than ever before. This people will give more people in Wyoming access to the best treatment to their cancer. It can be a complicated subject, but it's really a pretty straightforward, not too complicated bill. I will pause for questions, and I say if we will focus on the bill, I think it would be helpful. As a means of research, I will simply say, and I don't mean to, but this is some of the research that was done. If there are questions on the sidebar, I would be glad to offer you the studies and all the things that have come out of other states who have had it, who have tried it, and I would offer you that 34 in regard to the findings that they've had in terms of cost, expense, and efficacy. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. I would then pause for any questions.
Questions? If Senator Meyer will go there first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at the language on page 2, lines 13 through 18, and I don't know if it does what the sponsor wants it to do, and I'll bring this up, that the first part of it talks about increasing copayments, deductibles, and coinsurance for covered and injector to intravenous chemotherapy. It doesn't talk necessarily about that for treatment medication, but it does say that you cannot reclassify benefits with respect to cancer treatment medications. And because we're using two different descriptors on the different types of therapy, I'm wondering if we're really getting where we wanted to go, or whether we should talk about the co-payment, deductible, and co-insurance for both injected intravenous and medications, and talk about the reclassifications for the injected intravenous and treatment medications. Because it seems like we might be leaving something out, and I don't want to leave anything out.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I certainly would beg any advice if we get to future readings, but I will say, lines 13 through 16, you know, there's two ways to achieve parity. You can raise a cost or you can lower a cost. The idea, of course, here is not to achieve parity. It's to lower the cost of the oral medication, not to raise the cost of the intravenous. So that pretty much, I think, addresses the purposes of Section B. If there's something hidden in there that I haven't interpreted, then I would beg advice from you and perhaps on a future reading.
Senator Meyer, following up?
Follow up. I guess I kind of look at it like a hypothetical might be that you've already met your copay for your prescription drugs. And so now we're saying that you're not going to reclassify the benefits for treatment medications, but I'm just wondering if you have parity and you've already met your copay, would that allow the insurance company to do something to make sure that you're paying the same as the covered, injected, or intravenous chemotherapy? And I'm not sure we're really getting where I'm rambling right now, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you are, Senator Meyer.
But I guess I'll maybe get back to LSO and see whether we can figure out.
Sounds like a great plan. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, I do have an employee who has a spouse that has been battling cancer on and off for many, many years. And as you know, cancer treatment has many regimes for battling cancer. Some of them are injectables, some of them are intravenous, and some of them are in a pill form. And what I understand from my employees that as these drugs are dispensed, as the physician prescribes a course of chemotherapy, some of the, after the chemotherapy is taken for a while, then you can't take that drug anymore. And so they have to switch to another drug. Sometimes that other drug does not come in an injectable or intravenous mode. Then you would have to take an oral product. So I believe that this bill does create the parity that we want. I know it's probably going to increase the cost of insurance companies, but that is the way that the chemotherapy business is dispensed. There are different forms of the drugs, and not every patient can take that particular drug, and they should not be penalized for having been prescribed an oral product. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I wish to report to the Senate that there is a risk in this bill, and it has to do with the mandate provisions in the Affordable Care Act. And let me just set those forth, and I hope to catch the attention of the real attorneys in the body trying to define what that risk is. This is Section 1311D1B single I, and it's found on page 70 of the consolidated print of the bill. In general, subject to the requirements of clause double I, a state may require that a qualified health plan offered in such state offer benefits in addition to the essential benefits specified under section 1302B. And then single I there, the state must assume cost, and the state shall make payments, Roman numeral 1, to an individual enrolled in a qualified health plan offered in such state, or Roman numeral 2, on behalf of an individual described in subclause Roman numeral 1, directly to the qualified health plan in which such individual is enrolled. And that section is very real. We had to appropriate money last year, year before, because we got persuaded to do a benefit that was a very rare benefit, fortunately, and didn't cost too much money, but we still had to appropriate money to compensate for having created a mandate. And this one somewhat looks like a mandate. And I think the guidance that was set forth in committee that came from CMS was that this wasn't a mandate within the meaning of that. And they wouldn't enforce it. But it looks to me like an individual or a health plan could enforce it, would have standing to, which is why I want the attorneys to pay some attention. And so if CMS is just interpreting the law to suit their convenience, as they've been known to do, this one might get tested. And it would be quite expensive if it did, because this is a common circumstance. Now, 30-some, I think it is, other states, and I could be corrected on the number, have done this and haven't had any adverse consequences yet. But it may take time for a case to mature. I raise it because I think it is a risk in this legislation that the Senate ought to be aware of. I think the combination of the guidance from CMS, which I suspect may be based on this law isn't requiring any cancer treatment, it's just requiring parity among two kinds. I don't know whether that'll stand up or not. And the fact that the other states have enacted it have not yet had any trouble. I think we're all right. I voted for the bill in committee. But I did think, in all honesty, I ought to read you the actual provision in the ACA, because I think it does run the risk that some individual or some insurance company, qualified health plan operator, would have standing to bring a case, and we'd run a legal risk. So, again, on balance, I think it's probably a risk worth running. I don't think it's too great, Mr. Chairman, but I think it's a real risk.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Dockstetter, will you
don't need it.
Give it up? Okay, Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Rising on and for the bill. I think this bill is good policy simply because I believe that in healthcare we should not punish success. Traditionally, most chemotherapies were given either by something through the arm, an infusion through the arm, infusion through the heart. And as medical science has advanced, many of these become, as the Senator had alluded to, oral chemotherapies. All of a sudden, they move from where they're covered 80% or 100% to a much more limited prescription drug benefit, which is kind of perverse because you take medical science, advancing it, so it's a much less intrusive therapy, much less expensive orally, and all of a sudden you pare back the coverage. And I have seen patients confronted with the thought of I can get greater coverage if I take it intravenously, whereas if I take it orally, I get less coverage, but I have less problems with the administration. And I think for purposes of policy, rise and speak in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if I may just take a moment to speak to the chairman of the Health Committee. And first of all, let me say, no person on this floor do I have greater respect for. And I look to this direction in regard to most all health issues. But I will remind you that this is about one thing. It's about parity between oral and intravenous treatment. There is no mandate. There's no dictation here in regard to what insurance plan a patient might have or might require. In regard to treatment, treatment takes place between that patient's doctor, be it their primary care doctor, an oncologist. They come up with the best treatment for that patient, for that type of cancer. There is no dictation in that. That is all done by the expert and between the patient. They might take into consideration the type of cost that would be incurred through that and whether or not the patient could willingly take that and afford that and continue with treatment. But there's nothing in here that dictates that. And I would certainly be reluctant to argue with anyone in regard to the authority of the ACA and to act in this. But the information that I have in regard to the 34 states, they have not encountered the difficulty that has been alluded to. And I would simply say if this bill were to move forward to, those are things that we can examine, better legal authority than I, and better investigation into the regulations that were held up for like this. So with that, I would beg your favorable consideration and call for the question.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. I want to be sure that I understand what we're doing here. Mr. Chairman, the first one is, do other insurance companies in our state offer this now? And I'm trying to remember, and our colleague from Laramie County was talking about his particular insurance company, and I can't remember if the particular company we have offers this, and if they in fact do, and it's there, what this does or how this affects that. If we already offer and it's available to them, then what is the purpose of trying to do this? The other thing I'm trying to get my handle around is those that are exempt. It goes to what the chairman of the Labor Committee is talking about, and we talk about 70,000 patients would benefit under this plan. But yet we exempt Medicaid, Medicare, all other things, and I wonder how can we provide it for 70,000, but these exempt status, what that might do, and then where do we come up with 70,000 patients? Is that number the amount of people in Wyoming that would be doing and utilizing oral chemotherapy? And I'm having trouble with that number. Maybe the sponsor could help me out with some of these questions.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
First of all, I would say in terms of exemptions, I'd bring you back again. Parity is just between the two type of treatments. We're not making any dictation. We're not making any mandates in regard to what's to be included within the two types of insurance. Some people may have a cancer clause, others may not. We're not dictating to an employer or to a company that you must provide cancer therapy or what the therapy might be, but simply in the event that there is a choice between oral and chemo, the idea being parity would be dictated so that you could receive the oral at an equitable cost or a parity with the intravenous. In regard to the $70,000, I'll just plead ignorance in the sense of that was the number that I was given, and I will pursue that. And I'd say that's a good question, but quite frankly, I would not be able to give you a satisfactory answer at this time.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess when we see these bills that go in and undertake to address a specific issue without knowing exactly what's happening, it gives me some pause and concern. In the past, we have said that in the event that there's a non-generic drug that's more expensive, but the doctors swear or they demonstrate that its efficacy is warranted for a condition, we've directed insurance companies that once the doctor certifies or takes some action to say that this drug, the generic drug, is not an adequate substitute and this patient needs this other drug, for those reasons we have intervened to say you're required to provide those types of coverage. In this instance, though, as near as I can tell, we're saying that the discrimination that exists is between oral and intravenous care, chemotherapy, and my assumption is that if there is a lack of parity, it may be because one drug is newer on the market, is more expensive, that and my experience is if, in fact, a newer drug, which may be more expensive, actually provides better treatment, that there is a mechanism for physicians to make an application. Insurance companies generally consider them. But if we're saying is that it's for the convenience of the patient would prefer to have oral instead of intravenous, even if it's 5 times, 10 times the expense, why would we say that? So I'm not quite certain now whether this is an issue about efficacy because the drug's there. Are we trying to say that even though these newer medications are, if in fact they're far more expensive and they don't provide more efficacy, if they don't provide a better treatment, you're still not allowed to discriminate between the drugs. These are the kinds of things that do throw up your insurance companies, your insurance policies out of whack because there's no way to control costs.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, first in part to answer that last question, and this is frankly what persuaded me to support the bill. The difference in cost appears to be just an artifact of the way insurance contracts are structured, where you have one deductible to satisfy for your inpatient treatment and another one for your prescription drugs. And, Mr. Chairman, the ones for the prescription drugs are generally geared to the normal varieties of prescription drugs we get, where you'll have several levels of tiers of copayments. Depending on how new the drug is, depending on how expensive it is, and they don't really fit this circumstance. And without this bill, you get into the circumstance where you get the same drug, can be either delivered intravenously or as a pill. You would think it would be more expensive, and it probably is, to do it with the IV treatment. You go into a center, you get an IV rigged up, you get monitored while you're getting it. I've seen more than I care to of that. Or you can take it as a pill. But because of the way the insurance contracts are structured, if it's inpatient medical treatment, you don't get stuck for the cost of the drug. You've satisfied the, probably, if you have cancer or something, you probably satisfied the co-payments, deductibles for that treatment. But the prescription drug, which was geared to the ordinary drugs, suddenly you've got a very expensive one, and they typically provide, yeah, the drug plan will pay some of the cost, but you'll pay most of it on one of those. So you get just an irrational result under the current structure, and that's what this bill is trying to cure. Now, you can say those drugs shouldn't be so expensive, but they are, partly because of the cost of developing them, partly because of the extraordinary cost of getting anything approved by our FDA, and the feds need to do something about that, and I don't see anything happening in that area. And so you've got those things, and then the promotion costs where you let the doctors know about them. All those costs add up, and they result in a very expensive drug that people have difficulty affording. So I think this bill is correcting an error there, and I want to make it very clear. I thought only in fairness to the Senate I ought to raise that there is a risk here due to the ACA. But I still think this bill is probably a good idea because it straightens out just an irrationality in our system that is costing some of our people a lot of money. And I would urge its adoption, and I hope I answered the question. Sometimes it is a question of efficacy, that the oral agent is newer and better, does a better job than the IV agent. And sometimes it's just a matter of the mechanics of the insurance policy. If you get the same drug one way, it's a lot cheaper than if you get it another way that looks like it makes a lot more sense.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I take it from that explanation that if an amendment were prepared that provided that in the event that there is a cost difference, and so that if one drug is, if they're the same drugs, but one is three times the cost of the other, that would not offend the purpose of the bill. In other words, you could discriminate because of the cost of the drug. You're not, the carriers, the insurance company is not forced to pay for a higher cost drug just because of this language. The assumption is that all things equal, the costs are the same. And maybe I'm not understanding that, but I guess if, so that's my question. If you bring out a brand new drug that happens to be an oral delivery and it costs 10 times the amount, and it doesn't do any better than the older product, and most likely there's a patent issue or something like that, would a carrier be able, under this language, be entitled to say, no, we're going to direct you to the less expensive one? Because as a member of the insurance plan, I don't know that I want to pay more premiums just so somebody can choose to take the more expensive option when there's no purpose in it.
Anybody else want to discuss this? Anybody else? Okay. The question is on Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the due pass recommendation on Senate File 62. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 62 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 126. Would the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 126, Water Quality, sponsored by Senator Hicks. That was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural State Public Lands and Water Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Emmerich, Vice Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Emmerich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a do pass on Senate File 126, Water Quality. There is a standing committee report, and I ask that it be read in this time.
Senate File 126, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 6.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for discussion of the amendment and the bill, I yield to Senator Hicks.
Okay. Senator Hicks, that amendment's been read in and has been moved.
Mr. Chairman,
I know.
What I'd like to do is dispense this amendment first.
Okay. If you'd move it. Thank you.
What this does is it just changes two words in the bill.
Sorry. Let me get your microphone on, Senator Hicks.
All right.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, would like to dispose of the amendment at this time. All that does is change two words, changes the word from alter to preclude. All that does is adopt the standard nomenclature of the Department of Environmental Quality. Alter doesn't show up. They use preclude through their water quality rules and regulations. So with that, Mr. Chairman, it's just a conforming to what the language used by the department. I'd ask for your favorable consideration of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 126.
Thank you. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 126, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is carried. Back to you, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, you got a handout earlier on your desk that says Senate File 126. It says Wyoming's Draft 204 Integrated 305B and 303D Report. I want to bring your attention to this. What I'm going to do, Mr. Chairman, is walk you through this report, and that will lead us back to the bill and show the need for the bill. So this is the state of Wyoming's. This is in a draft form. It's in their triennial review. This goes into category 4C surface waters, and I'm going to walk through these so you understand what we're doing in the bill. So the first one is we get to Grass Creek. That's in Hot Springs in Washakie County. If you go across there, it talks about the number of miles and acres. It shows that there's 14.1 miles, and then it goes to the cause of the impairment, and this is the point I want you to focus on. And the cause of the impairment is flow alterations. So if we go down the list, the next one is Crooked Creek. That's in Bighorn County, 7.9 miles. The cause of the impairment is flow alterations. We go down to the next one on the list, which is Muddy Creek, 17.5 miles, and it's listed for flow alterations. Next one's Rock Creek in Carbon County, 106 miles. Cause of impairment is flow alterations. If you change to the next page, Mr. Chairman, go through the list. We now into the North Platte River Basin. This is in Converse County. It's Horseshoe Creek, 7.3 miles. Cause of impairment, flow alterations. Going down the list, and we're now into the Powder River Basin, North Fork of Crazy Woman Creek in Sheridan County. 28 miles is listed as impaired due to flow alterations. The next one's Soldier Creek, 17 miles, listed as impairment, flow alterations. And members of the body, if I can have you to flip over to the next page, this describes what a Section 4C classification is. Under DEQ rules, Class 4Cs are isolated waters, with an emphasis on isolated, that have been determined to lack the potential to normally support or sustain aquatic life pursuant to the provisions Section 33B, Romanet I, 3I, 4, 5, and 6 under these regulations. The first thing I want to point out to you that when you have 17 miles or 106 miles of a creek, that's not an isolated water. One of the problems that we have under this classification is we're trying to pound square pegs into round holes. None of these water bodies listed on this list by their very nature are isolated. They're all stream segments within an existing stream within a watershed. If you go on to finish reading that, where it says isolated waters that have been determined to lack the potential to normally support or sustain aquatic life pursuant to the provisions of this section. It goes on and talks about off-channel effluent ponds and all this. Again, this really doesn't fit the situation that we're dealing with. When we talk about flow alterations, unless you go to someplace like the headwaters in Yellowstone Park, there's not a river and a stream in the state of Wyoming that doesn't incur some type of flow alterations. The minute that you put a diversion on there or a dam on there, you've created a flow alteration. So long term, the implications is potentially every stream in the state of Wyoming could be implicated under a Class 4C as an impaired water due to flow alterations. Now, I brought this to the attention of the Department of Environmental Quality that we're trying to stick something in here where it really doesn't belong. And after the last month of discussions with the department, that I think they've come to the realization that these things really are not isolated waters. And they really need to start working on a different way we classify them. I'm going to go through what those classifications do. So if we go back to the individual creeks, when it says they're impaired due to flow alterations, the specific provisions as to why they're altered, if we go back to that original list, is because aquatic life other than fish or cold water fishies are not supported. If we get back to Crooked Creek, impaired aquatic life other than fish, which is basically insects, could be algae, that's an aquatic life form. Periphyton is something other parameter that we use to evaluate water quality. We go over to Muddy Creek. This one's listed not because of aquatic life forms, because the channel is probably not likely to return to its natural form. We get to Rock Creek. It's because the cold water fisheries and the aquatic life form uses on Rock Creek have now changed. They've been impaired. There was also some language in there talking about the ability to transport sediment through that system is one of the impairments. If you go to Horseshoe Creek on Converse County, it says that exhibit degraded habitat due to irrigation withdrawals. The degradation is aquatic life form other than fish and cold water fishery uses. Go on down the list of Sheridan County, degraded macroinvertebrate and fish communities. Last one in Sheridan County there on Soldier Creek was aquatic life forms impaired on Soldier Creek. So what's all this mean? Well, what it means is that if you're exercising your legal rights under the state of Wyoming, whether you're a municipality or an industry or an irrigator, to divert water, and that diversion alters what the biological or ecological potential of that system is, under the current language under 4C, what that says is you've impaired that water or you've precluded the ability of that water to attain a cold water fisheries or an aquatic life form, which is insects, or could be, again, algae or some life form. The point is here we're exercising a legal right under the state of Wyoming. So the department was stuck with a conundrum. We go to 4C. These are not isolated waters. In fact, they're really one of the problematic things with the definition of using isolated waters is, because EPA does review these reports, isolated waters isn't consistent with the Supreme Court rulings on what constitutes waters of the United States. Under that provision, we may be, in some cases, opening up additional scrutiny and additional regulatory authority because we don't have a definition of isolated waters that comports with the Supreme Court rulings. So let's fast forward to the bill, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman. Pretty simple bill. I've worked with the department to do this. It says under the administrative authority, this would carve out a new Section C under 3511.302. It just says nothing in this act shall be construed to supersede or abrogate any valid water right. It is recognized that the diversion of water caused by the exercise of a valid water right is allowable, and therefore the administrator shall. This is what will happen once we have these valid water rights in these streams now, is develop water quality standards for surface waters that are hydrologically modified resulting from the exercise of a valid water right, the attainment of existing water rights preclude the attainment of the existing water quality standards. The next section just says they'll go through a schedule to these seven streams that are already listed on here and conduct what they do is called a use attainability analysis. So what it will do is go in, they'll conduct a study that basically says it's changed. Before it may have supported cold water fish, now it will only support insects. It'll be that class of water. Mr. Chairman, all this does is give the Department of Environmental Quality the direction to go in there and reclassify these streams and then set standards now for these streams that fall into this scenario because of diversions of water. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions.
Questions for the Senator. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand what the bill is doing. I want to be sure that where we have primacy under the EPA with our own DEQ, that this doesn't in any way, shape, or form affect that primacy and the classification they have. And I'm not familiar with USC 1315B that probably relates to that. But that's the question. Primacy, what the effects might be, and if we have any difficulty with the EPA over this.
Senator Scott. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, in fact, we went through four or five iterations of this bill to address exactly that concern. So this language is the language that the department assured me that would not infringe upon the state of Wyoming's primacy over water quality, Mr. Chairman. So that's exactly the language it's supposed to do, is to do exactly what the question was. This is the fourth iteration of this to make sure that this does not impede Wyoming's primacy over water quality.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to understand the practical import of this bill. Suppose you have a typical tributary stream in this state, has a number of irrigators on it with varying priorities of water right, and they divert water at times when they're diverting. There's plenty of water. You'd never notice it in the flow. They put it out in the land. At times, the diversion will entirely dry up the creek for a mile or two below a head gate. And then the creek will revive because it's getting springs fed by return flows from the earlier irrigating, and you'll get a better flow than you ever would naturally. So, and that's the way our streams typically work. As I listen to the explanation of the bill, it sounds to me like that under current DEQ practices, they could come along and say, because you dried up, you took your water and you dried up a segment, you've impaired it, and your water right is gone. You can't do that, which would be enormously destructive, would be a very common circumstance, Mr. Chairman, such that you'd have to worry about the government agency playing favorites and only getting after it where they didn't approve of something that the individual was doing, just being arbitrary and capricious. And that the net effect would be to dry up the irrigation in the state and do considerable harm to the flows in our creeks, particularly in the late summer, when some of them would otherwise go all the way dry if they didn't have the return flows and the maintenance of flows in order to satisfy higher priority irrigators downstream. Does this bill prevent that particular mischief? The language is sufficiently convoluted, I can't read the bill and say that it does or doesn't.
I knew there was a question in there somewhere. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, the question that was posed is exactly the question that this bill gets at. Under the current scenario is exactly what the good senator from Natrona County described, is it would come back and say you basically violated the Clean Water Act or have the potential to violate the Clean Water Act. In fact, there's EPA technical bulletins out there right now, specific to the example on Rock Creek where they talked about sediment transport, that they're now looking at sediment transport and clean sediment as an impairment and establishing a TMDL for sediment transport. Well, what's the ramification? If you read the EPA technical bulletin and you go in there, they say, well, you can mitigate this. Well, the only way to mitigate it is to restore the natural hydrology of the system.
or in the case described by the good senator from Natrona County, if it was just an aquatic life form, under our laws, what you would do is you'd go in there, say under prior appropriation doctrine, the guy with the later water right, you just start shutting them off until all of a sudden you get that aquatic life form back in the system. So has it happened? No, hasn't happened. This is a forward-looking thing saying let's get addressed this. But the simple fact is we continue to see EPA overreach time and time again under the Clean Water Act. 4 times the Supreme Court has come back and said you've overreached. We've got Bayside River or Bayview Riverside. We've got Tulloch. We've got the Swank. We've got Rapanos. So the potential is real for the agency to come out here and overreach and do exactly what the good senator from Natrona County said. This is to try to address that. While it's inferred right now that a water exercise of a legal water right wouldn't be contemplated, it's not specific in law. What this does says if you've got a legal water right, you have the right to exercise to do that. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Jim Anderson, James Lee Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One little correction on the handout material. It says the North Fork of Crazy Woman is in Sheridan County, and it's running from the Muddy Creek Road, 28 miles, to the confluence of the Middle Fork of Powder River. I think that's all in Johnson County, but might not make any difference to the information.
Thank you very much. Further discussion on Senate File 126. Further discussion. Are you ready for the question? The question is on Senator Emmerich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 126. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 126 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. What is your pleasure? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 129, due pass amended. Senate File 132, due pass amended. Senate File 62, due pass. And Senate File 126, due pass amended. Senator Case, Chairman.
Chairman Case.
Mr. President, I would move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Next order of business is standing committee reports.
February the 2nd. 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flader, and Senator Cooper, Acting Chairman.
Do you have any more reports? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, February 3rd.
Announcements. Senator Geis.
Mr. President, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources will meet on Tuesday night in S-15 upon adjournment. And we'll take up Senate File 133, Bighorn Sheep Relocation, and Senate File 134, Bighorn Sheep Plan.
Senator Ross. Ross.
Senator Ross. Don't eat them.
Mr. President, your Joint Appropriations Committee will meet at 4 p.m. in room 204 to consider the General Government Appropriations Bill. Tomorrow at noon, your Senate Appropriations Committee will meet shortly after the noon recess, after we've grabbed a bite, to consider the following bills: Senate File 141, State Budget Development; Senate File 146, Spending Policy Amendments; and then we'll take up the re-referral of the Waiver Stabilization Account, Senate File 67.
Senator Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, your Committee Number 8, Transportation, will meet at 4 o'clock in room S14 to discuss Senate File 95, Speed Limits; Senate File 137, Farm License Plates; Senate File 127, Transportation, Education, Revenue Distribution.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your number one committee, Judiciary, will meet Tuesday, 15 minutes after the noon recess in room S1, to continue on Senate File 115, Discrimination.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 7, Corporations, will meet tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. to continue our discussions on telecommunications. But first, we're going to hear Senate File 142, Building Code Regulation, and then we'll lump together both Senate File 43, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Revisions, and Senate File 140, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Rewrite. We are going to continue our last in our series of informal workshop discussions upon adjournment today in Senate 19.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room S14 to consider Senate File 109, State Parks Leases, Legislative Approval.
Last man standing, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Tuesday, tomorrow, 30 minutes afternoon recess in room S16 to take up Senate File 96, Special Investigator, and Senate File 122, Vision 2020.
No further announcements. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, February 3rd.